Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Under Commentary. This is Owen Tracy, recording is 2:25 PM, that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is December 28th, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, certainly what I would like to really talk about right now is the credit markets, because it's not something that we particularly pay a great deal of attention to for the vast majority of time, but there are certain times when it is of particular attention. Or that we really should be paying attention to, because the credit markets tend to lead the equity markets. It's not the other way around. So that's, I think, important. It's something that we really should spend some time to look at. Then we've had one of the most expletive-laden Decembers in history, and markets have pulled back very sharply. We've had a very impressive rebound on the 26th, and now people are asking the question whether this is a low or the low for this correction. And there are arguments on both sides. In fact, if one were to go through the various reports and outlooks for 2019, then I think it's possible at this stage to find one that could support just about any argument. So I think what we should really concentrate on is to analyze the chart action to let us or give us a true perspective on exactly what it is that people are doing with their money, because if one were to look at the range of possible outcomes that there are, then we have just an incredible array. So here we have, if we start off and look at the Blackstone Senior Loan ETF. The loans are the leveraged loan market has been pulling back extraordinarily aggressively over the last few months. And the ETF had a pricing issue on the 26th because there was so much short covering that it had difficulty keeping up. But the reality is that it accelerated down. It was due a bounce, and it has had the bounce. Now the question is the extent to which that low is going to hold. So certainly this is one of the areas which is out there on the horizon. One thing that I can tell from the mail that is arriving through our letterbox every day is that the vast majority of mortgage lending today happens through non-bank lenders. So that is an area of the market that is less regulated, but is also largely, at this stage at least, still unlisted. So it doesn't really have an impact on the stock market. It's not something that we can really monitor easily with charts. But the reality is that we have a very large number of companies that have been borrowing in the loan market rather than the debt markets. And the reason that they've been able to do that has been because of extraordinarily low interest rates. It's also been because of this search for yield among investors, because they're willing to take on additional risks in order to capture the yield that they require. And therefore, it's been a win-win both for the borrower and the creditor. But of course, nobody really reads covenants. Nobody really pays much attention to any of these sorts of loan portfolios until they start going bad. And what we have certainly seen is that there is increasing disquiet among investors about the outlook for the bond markets, but most particularly the corporate bond markets, for the simple reason that there is a wall of refinancing that has to occur in 2019, 2020, and 2021. And that's against a background where we didn't really have a lot of we didn't have a lot of refinancing that had to get done in 2018. So I think that that's something that is rather important here, that what we have seen has been that we've had a very extensive pullback in terms of these loan portfolios, and that has coincided with something that we can monitor in the markets, which is high yield spreads, because obviously the bond markets are very well and easily analyzable. And when we look at the high yields on US corporate debt, then it's cruised through 500 basis points in here this week. Now, there is something of a psychological Rubicon to the 500 basis point handle, because it's generally speaking around these sorts of occasions when the spread goes above 500 basis points that things start to look ropey for the stock market. And it's really only just broken above 500 basis points. We've seen, for example, back in 2011 and again in 2015 and 16 that it got up towards about 800 basis points before turning around. So there is the potential here for the spread to widen out further. But if, for example, we then now look at the S&P 500 over a similar time frame, well, we can see that we had a pretty meaningful pullback in 2011 and again in 2015 and 2016. And in between those occasions, we had very beautifully consistent trending markets. Well, now we are at a more elevated level. The price has already pulled back really very sharply. This is the biggest pullback on the S&P 500 we've seen since 2009. It is a major trend inconsistency. And not only have we extended a move below the trend mean, and it is a significant move below the trend mean, but that mean has now also turned downwards, and it is being led lower by some of the biggest companies. Well, of course, the biggest companies have also been among those that have got the highest valuations, those that have been doing so extraordinarily well that it was a very clear narrowing of breadth in terms of this market. And now when we've had the significant pullbacks in shares like Apple and indeed Facebook, which led the large cap sector lower, then that has weighed on the stock market. Apple has gone, has pulled back to $150. This is by far the largest pullback we've seen in a very significant period of time, even on a logarithmic scale chart. So this also is now showing up as a somewhat larger pullback. It is coming back towards the region of the upper side of the most recent of those big ranges that Apple has put in, and we've seen the first evidence of steadying starting to come in right now. But what we can also glean from Apple's advance over the course of the last decade has been that when it peaks, then it takes anything up to about 18 months before it can revisit that peak. And it has tended to do quite a lot of bumbling around to find a low before it can start to rally once more. Well, certainly there is an oversold condition here that the price today is approximately $30 overextended relative to the trend mean, and a rebound in that order would unwind approximately 50% of the decline. So there is certainly the potential here for some short covering and for a rebound, but there has been sufficient trend deterioration that we could anticipate that in a best case scenario it is going to take time above all else for these conditions to improve. Well, when we then look at the high yield sector in the USA is above 500 basis points. When we look at the high yield spread on the Europeans sector, well, what we're then presented with is a measure that has been trending higher for most of this year already. It's now approaching 600 basis points. Well, the last time I looked at these in a longer term video, they were all around the same value. Well, when we look at Asia, what this is also, I think, really telling us is that we have conditions where, and let me just make sure that I'm typing this correctly, that when we look at the global aggregate for the high yield spreads, then they're trending higher. This is very clearly an uptrend in terms of tightening credit conditions. And it is all as a result of the fact that the liquidity situation globally has been contracting for just about the last 9 months. And this is the biggest contraction in liquidity that we've seen in decades. So that's meaningful because I think it's one of the things we talk about first at the chart seminar. This is about as basic, it's almost tautological in terms of its simplicity, but when there's a lot of money about, it's easier to make some. And when there's less of it about, it's more difficult. This is not exactly rocket science, but it does tell us where we are in terms of the ease with which it is to make money in the markets. When the global liquidity is tightening, then it does have a knock-on effect. Well, this then helps us to begin to answer the question. So when we're looking at, for example, the S&P 500, well, we can certainly say that in the short term, which I would consider anything from about from a few weeks to a few months, we certainly have a short-term oversold condition, and we had a very clear upside key day reversal on the 26th. We had some follow-through, and not a great deal, but we did follow through on the upside yesterday. So now we certainly have a near-term low. But in order for this to be a medium-term low, then we're going to first have to see it find support at a higher level. So we're going to have to see a higher reaction low, and that higher reaction low will have to hold. Then we're going to have to see a higher high. But then we have an area of overhead resistance around 2600. So the big question is whether it is going to be able to push up and into that overhead range. Well, then of course you have another big question. Is it going to be able to sustain a move back above the trend mean? Considering the size of the pullback, the fact that we have had a loss of momentum, then the failed upside break, the massive reaction against the prevailing trend, the break in the progression of higher reaction lows, and now we're trading well below the trend mean. Well, this is increasingly looking like top formation completion. So therefore, it is going to require more in order to really demonstrate that we are back in a demand-dominated environment. And this is the big consideration, that there are obviously arguments that we have had a significant pullback, valuations have improved, and now the question is whether they have improved enough in order to be truly appetizing from the perspective of investors. I sent this article to myself earlier on today, and I wanted to highlight it for you. It's the Treasury runoff. So we can see, for example, that the Treasury was bumping up against the maximum amount of bonds they're willing to let go all the way through 2017 and 18, and that has we're probably entering a period from 2019 onwards, and particularly after the second half, when the runoff in bonds is going to moderate. So we've seen certainly that there's been a lot of runoff, and that the size of the Fed's balance sheet has been contracting at a very steady level. But when we look at the trend, then certainly the pace of the decline has been picking up over the course of the last few months, and they're anticipating that it's going to be in the order of $600 billion next year. Well, that does help to put into perspective what we saw at the Fed's last meeting, because they said they were thinking about raising rates twice. Well, I think that's extraordinarily unlikely, but that's only half the story, because it was a figure that Jeff Gundlach has been quoting, that by their calculations, that every $200 billion that is withdrawn from the size of the Fed's balance sheet is equivalent to approximately a quarter of a or a 25 basis point interest rate hike. If the Fed goes ahead and removes $600 billion from circulation next year, even if it is only $450 billion, then it's still going to equate to two interest rate hikes, and potentially even three. So, therefore, what they're really telling us is that their plans were to do five interest rate hikes next year, and in fact, it's probably going to be closer to 2.5. But that's still contractionary, and that's taking money out of the system. So this is a very different environment than we've had in any time since 2011, or indeed back in 2008. On both occasions, we had liquidity tightening, and that contributed to a ranging environment. Now, the bigger question isn't so much about what the Fed is going to do with interest rates. That's really already in the price. The much bigger question is what they're going to do in terms of the size of their balance sheet. Then, of course, you have the ECB. And when we look at the ECB, then they have just ended their quantitative easing program. And there is a video that I'm posting in Comment of the Day today. It's well worth taking the time to look at, but it really focuses on target 2 balances. So when we compare the target 2 balances for Germany with the chart of the size of the ECB's balance sheet, well, they look pretty similar. And in fact, when we put the ratio up, and I need to just remember the ticker that I created for it. So that's not it. When we look at the this index, I created this in here today. So what this is showing us is that when you divide the size of the Bundesbank's balance sheet by its T2 balances, then you get a straight line, which means that they are moving in lockstep. Well, what that also tells us is that the mechanism through which the ECB has been extending the size of its balance sheet has been directly through the expansion of the T2 balances from the Bundesbank. Well, the Bundesbank is a creditor, and when we look at the T2 balances for Italy, well, then they've been going down in exactly the same fashion. But they're moving in the exact opposite direction. So what it is essentially giving us a picture of is that the target 2 mechanism has been the conduit through which the ECB's monetary largesse has been channeled into the coffers of the debtor nations. This is a rather significant balance for Italy. And when we look at the figures, we're talking about billion. When we look at Spain, then it's all also coming back down towards its lows. So these are two of the biggest debtors to the target system. But they owe their money to the Eurozone. They don't owe it to Germany. Germany has got a draw on the Eurozone, not so much on Italy or Spain. So this represents it's another example of this contradiction that underlies the Eurozone, that the Euro was created as a tool for a federal state. And it has got the transfer mechanisms already instituted in order to facilitate a federal state mechanism where you could have the weaker economies being supported by the stronger economies. But the fact of the matter is that the Eurozone is not a federal state. It's it is simply a cooperation between a significant number of countries that is largely voluntary in nature. And is very often consensus driven. So when you think about the veto actions that a number of countries still have, and most particularly within the European Commission, then it really does ram home just how fragile the European system is. Well, when we then look at the outlook for European markets, well, Germany is on the cusp of a recession. And what we've seen over the course of the last few weeks has been that global demand for autos is decreasing. And considering that it was expected to grow by 3% this year, it is contracting by 2%. China has got capacity to produce 48 million vehicles and only needs approximately 28 million. Well, of course, they're producing all of that excess capacity for the export market. And Germany has got two big sources of demand for its vehicles, and that is, at least outside the Eurozone, it's the USA and China. Well, Chinese demand is declining. And that is one of the causal effects behind the underperformance that we're seeing in German assets. So the DAX has pulled back aggressively. It's now coming back towards the 10,000 level. It is equally likely that it is going to get some short covering coming in here around the 10,000 level. But that's a very clear top formation overhead. And the much bigger question isn't so much the extent to which it's going to rally, but its ability to sustain a move back above that 12,000 level, which is likely to be a bit of a Rubicon. Now, when we look at the MDAX, then we also have very clear top formation completion characteristics. We certainly have these oversold conditions. So that is the big question, is whether we're going to see these indices trade back above their trend means anytime soon. Best case scenario is that we move into a ranging phase, and that could last for anything from 6 months to a year, considering the depth of the issues that we have here. But when we look at the banking sector, well, what is particularly, I think, relevant here is that the ECB's quantitative easing program did absolutely nothing to improve the prospects for the European banking sector. And the reason for that is because they never dealt with their portfolios of bad loans. And they never went through a foreclosure crisis. They never went through writing off the debts. So that's out there in the future. If anything, Europe is on a path towards a Japan-style deflation, and there isn't much that they're going to be able to do about it unless they start to write off the debts. But of course, that is politically untenable, considering that the creditors are all in the north and the debtors are all in the south. So this is also part of the reason why you've had this fiscal austerity regime that's been going on for the better part of the last decade, and it's starting to come apart at the seams, because you can simply cannot expect hundreds of millions of people to accept lower standards of living with no end in sight. So that is part of the reason why you've had the populist regime pop up in Italy. It's the reason why you have the yellow vests protesting in France. It's why the AfD in Germany has now got seats in the Bundestag. That's why Orban is charge in Hungary. It's why you have Poland coming up against strictures from the European Commission. These are all, I think, facets of the same problem. Well, if we then look at populism on a global basis, you have the Trump administration, you have Modi in India, you have Abe in Japan. These are all running populist programs. Well, this is a global phenomenon. You've Bolsonaro in Brazil, who is running right-wing populism, and then you have AMLO in Mexico running left-wing populism. But populism is populism because all it is trying to answer is the question that people are asking: what about me? They want an answer to that. And what we're starting to see now is that globally, we have got a position where there are a significant number of economies have got very low unemployment. But the fact is that people have been experiencing lower standards of living because the jobs that they have simply do not pay well enough, and their wages have not inflated along with the cost of living. And that has contributed to lower standards of living that people are now starting to complain about. And now the much bigger question is, when we start to see an economic contraction, and that is a realistic possibility, that when you do get this tightening of credit and it happens on a global basis, well, the way that it ends is when a central bank, and it would have to be a big one, steps in and says that they're going to provide as much liquidity as is required for their particular economy to prosper, but that you get leakage and capital is both global and mobile, so it flows to the most attractive assets. Well, that's exactly what happened in 2015 and 2016. The Federal Reserve ended its quantitative easing program, and the ECB just kicked off its program. Now the big question is, what's China going to do? What's Japan going to do? Those are the other two big economies. They have been moderating the pace with which they've been pushing money into the system. But we're going to have to see a very clear signal that we're moving towards a more stimulative environment. So that is one of the potential catalysts that could drive us up and out of this correction. It would be that we get a massive stimulus from China, or from an additional boost from the USA if they adopt an infrastructure bill. Well, of course, they can't even keep the government open right now, so getting bipartisan support for an infrastructure bill, it might be a bit of an ask in the next few months. So what that is telling us is that we have, in the short term, certainly got potential for a rebound, but at the medium term is that the best case scenario is that we're going to have a more rangy environment, and the worst case scenario is that after this short covering rally, that markets keep going down. So the kinds of things that would be lead indicators for a rebound would be for the banks to start exhibiting relative strength, because that would suggest that we have a better liquidity situation globally. Then, if high yield spreads start to come back down, then that would be a very clear sign that the low is in for stock markets, and it would be certainly a time to then go back to a shopping list and start looking at things that are looking attractive on a valuations basis. But so far, that's not yet the case, which suggests that this rally that we've seen could potentially be dead cat in nature. But it's, I think, very likely that the lows are going to be retested. So that is when then the really big questions are going to be answered. Well, when we come back then and think about the bond markets, well, 10-year treasuries have steadied in here today, and they actually moved on to new recovery highs. So we didn't see a significant drawdown in terms of the pullback that we had on the 26th, and it's been completely countermanded over the last 2 days. Well, what this is beginning to suggest is that investors are beginning to look for safe havens, and that they are willing to tolerate the risk that is outstanding in the bond markets. There is a wall of treasury debt that needs to be refinanced next year, and that's something that is going to represent a rather significant source of potential indigestion for the markets. We can see, for example, that there is a lot of public debt repayments that need to happen in 2019, 20, and 21. Then it starts to fall again after 21. And of course, part of the reason for that is because the U.S. Treasury has been front-loading its debt sales in the first 3 years. It's hard to really rationalize why they've been doing that. Why wouldn't a bank take the opportunity to lend at extraordinarily long maturities when you had some of the lowest interest rates in generations available? But the fact of the matter is that the Treasury did not do that. It means they've got an awful lot of debt that needs to be refinanced on an ongoing basis. And that is equally true of the investment grade markets. Well, investment grade bonds, we can look at, for example, the CDS. And the CDS on investment grade bonds is right now coming up to the highs we saw in 2015 and 2016, and it's close to the peaks we saw in 2011 and 2012. So this is about where, if support is going to be found, well, this is where we would anticipate it starting to happen. So, but we also know that the pressure that's come to bear on the senior loan markets, and a lot of those loans would be considered to be investment grade. Well, the big overlying or overhanging questions on the bond markets is how many of these companies are going to be downgraded, and what kind of effect is that going to have on the credit environment? When, for example, we look at some of the bigger issuers that could potentially be downgraded, then Ford is looking oversold in the short term, but has been trending down now for almost 5 full years. And GE is the second worst performer on the S&P 500 this year. It's been kicked out of the Dow Jones Industrial Averages. It's at least, it's stopped going down at least over the course of the last few weeks. There has been a lot of forced selling where it basically halved between October and the beginning of December. And that was all on the fear that it was going to be turned into a junk bond. Well, the yield on the subordinated 5% perpetual is currently around 18.96%. Well, that'll tell us that just where people anticipate the risks are, that there is the potential it could be downgraded, and that if you're holding the debt, this would be the first thing to default. Well, in the event that GE does not default, then there is definitely attractive yields out there right now. When, for example, we look at Argentina's debt, well, I'm not suggesting that anybody run out and buy the debt, but we can see, for example, that it's 2117 bonds, the 100-year bonds, which were issued on a bullet basis, are currently yielding about 10%, and that really, I think, tends to put in perspective what we are presented with, that Argentina right now is considered to be a less of a risk than GE on a 100-year basis. And that tells us that there is a potentially a mispricing in the market, but at least that there's a lot of bad news has already been priced in. So there are value opportunities that are presenting themselves right now. And then we also know that this is the last couple of days of the year, so that there is a lot of chopping and changing in portfolios in order to get ready for the new year. Well, the one asset that really is starting to perform right now is gold. And gold prices tend to do best when they're appreciating in all currencies. So let's look at some of those. And maybe we should really go back to maybe 2010 so that we can get the peak in. Certainly there is a rally going on against in US dollar terms, but the Australian dollar price of gold is testing its all-time highs. When we look at it against the pound, then it has broken a succession of lower rally highs. The euro is testing its sequence of lower rally highs. When we look at the Brazilian real, it is pushing on to test the peaks that we've seen over the course of the last 3 years, and that's substantially above the levels seen in 2011. Well, that also helps to ram home the point that we have had a substantial devaluation in the real. In rupees, the price is back testing the peak from 2016. We're coming up towards Chinese New Year, so this is a traditional buying time for the Chinese investors, and the price is coming back up to test the 9,000 renminbi level. So we've seen here that gold is starting to appreciate in an increasingly large number of currencies, and it is on the cusp of doing better than that. It's in the cusp of breaking out to new all-time highs in a significant number of the weaker currencies, particularly the commodity currencies. So that's potentially important here, that when we look at the credit situation and we look at the firmness that we're seeing in the treasury markets, well, that's also starting to create demand for safe haven type assets. And gold is certainly one of those. So gold prices, though, tend to do best when they're appreciating in all currencies. But more importantly than that, gold tends to be a hedge against the temptation of government to either monetize their debt or devalue the currency. Well, considering the quantity of debt that needs to be refinanced, and that's happening against a background where the where we have had record low unemployment and rising inequality. So that is against, so when we think about the fact that liquidity is tightening, that risks in the bond markets are increasing, we've had record issuance of covenant loans, that there is an awful lot of debt that needs to be refinanced. Well, that, and then we also, against that background, have to look at what is in fact happening, where we have had pro-cyclical policies adopted already in the USA, that the UK, France, and Italy are all adopting fiscally stimulative budgets. There is the realistic possibility that the Modi administration is going to attempt to buy the next election and run loose fiscal policy until at least the middle of next year. China is talking about a major fiscal stimulus, but not yet. But of course, what this is all going to do is put pressure on the integrity of their respective currencies. So if we are in fact going towards a period of synchronized fiscal expansion, which is looking increasingly likely, then the hedge against the devaluation of currencies that is going to entail is gold. And gold prices are looking increasingly likely that they are going to at least push back up towards the upper side of their range in US dollars, but then potentially could break out. So that's a potential outcome that we, I think, have to at least pay some consideration for that gold could potentially do substantially better from here. Silver prices just broke above the $15 level in here this week and are now just above the trend mean. There's been a clear downward bias to trading over the course of the last 3 years, and this is really the first evidence that we're seeing some real return to demand dominance in here for silver prices. The fact, though, that silver has been bubbling around $15 for the last 4.5 years is really a testament to the rising cost of marginal production. It's the rising cost of marginal production is the defining characteristic behind any secular bull market in commodities. And when we look at what's going on in terms of the copper price, then it broke down last week and then it has at least steadied in here this week. But it really needs to push back above the trend mean in order to clearly demonstrate a return to demand dominance. So we've talked a fair bit about the short term and we've talked something about the medium term. But I think the big question that a lot of people are now asking is about the long term. Well, the long term, if we're going to have this, what we've considered to be a secular bull market persist, then we're going to need to see productivity growth. It's really productivity growth is the clear arbiter of whether you get a secular bull market. I do think that there is a realistic possibility that we are going to get the productivity growth that's required. The first reason for that is because of oil prices. Oil prices have pulled back extraordinarily aggressively. Well, part of the reason they've pulled back so aggressively was largely engineered by the Trump administration, by giving a free pass to the biggest consumers of Iranian oil, then around the sanctions, then that added back in at a over a billion, excuse me, million barrels of oil per day that had largely been excised from the market. So that has contributed to a very meaningful decline. Well, oil prices are now looking really very oversold, but there is also that is acting as a stimulative measure for the vast majority of consuming nations. Well, it's arguable whether the USA is still a consumer or on a net basis or not. The USA is now, I think it's accurate at least to say that they have got a balanced energy system where they are still importing some, but they're exporting as well. And there will be months when it is a net energy importer and others when it is a net energy exporter. So these are very important facts. This is if we get lower energy prices, then that is stimulative. It means that more people have more money in their pockets. Well, that's predicated on the internal combustion engine. But of course, the other side of that equation is that battery technology is improving all the time. That two of the things that have really popped up on my radar over the course of the last few weeks has been that companies like Porsche and Volkswagen have been bringing out superchargers for their prospective lines of electric vehicles. And the future is electric because that is what the car companies are all going to be producing from approximately 2020 onwards. And that represents a significant drawdown in terms of demand for oil. Well, what that means is that the higher cost producers of oil are going to be excised from the market, and that's of particular concern to countries like Canada. Well, the Canadian dollar is not looking particularly strong in here, and the US dollar continues to trend higher against it, and Canada is a significant but high cost producer of oil. Then we have to think about deep water. Then there's a lot of deep water wells may never be productive because oil prices will simply not justify the economics of getting it done. And that is a situation that could persist for a very significant period of time. Well, if oil prices are in a secular bear market, and I would consider that to be that they are likely to range from the mid to high 30s up to approximately $80 on multi-year rolling basis, then that's I think the best case scenario for oil prices. I think it's extraordinarily unlikely we're going to see prices sustained above $80 for anything other than a few months, and that would be in response to a major geopolitical event. Well, lower energy prices are something that will contribute to improving productivity. Then you have artificial intelligence, automation, robotics. These are all sectors that are continuing to improve at an exponential rate. Then we have CRISPR. Then we've also seen, for example, the healthcare sector has been innovating at an accelerating rate, that immuno-oncology is a major potential game changer in terms of one of the biggest cost centers for the global economy. So if we do start to see people living longer, healthier lives, and with a lower mortality rate, then all of that will contribute to productivity growth. If, in addition to that, we have artificial intelligence and the range of potential functions that artificial intelligence can do is improving all the time. Well, those are the conditions that a secular bull market is predicated on. But we need to get over the hump of this debt issue. That is something that is right there, front and center right now. Something that Ray Dalio talks about is the short-term debt cycle, and it's looking increasingly likely that the short-term debt cycle is ending, for the simple reason that we have had a phenomenal advance in asset prices. The quantitative easing wasn't really particularly effective in terms of wealth redistribution or the trickle-down effect, but it was enormously successful at inflating asset prices. Well, quantitative tightening and the resulting fiscal stimulus is probably better at the trickle-down effect, but not so great at inflating asset prices. So that's the situation that we're in right now, that there is the potential here that we're going to be in a rather lengthy corrective phase. And this is before we see economies slowing down. So when we look at the yield curve spread, then it has been expanding over the course of the last few sessions. It's now at about 20 basis points. But when we look at the longer term chart, then it's still in a downtrend. It's looking increasingly likely that it will invert. And what that holds out the prospect of is that the Federal Reserve will have to cut interest rates. Well, it's generally after the first time that the Fed cuts interest rates that markets pull back most. It's not really until they have cut aggressively and all the data, which is released on a lagged basis, often by up to 2 quarters, is looking most dire, that prices are that value investors really get the kind of bargains that they salivate over and often spend the next decade looking for again. So that's what that really suggests to us right now, is that we are towards the end of this cycle. This is definitely late cycle activity. The fact that we have this war going on between those that think that this is nothing more than a blip and that the market is going to race higher again, versus those that think that this is the top. Well, what that is telling us is that there is a market now in these views, and that, generally speaking, that contributes to higher volatility, and we have certainly seen higher volatility. But I think one of the other important points is that if we look at the VIX index, generally speaking, it's when it goes to significant highs that we see that as a potential buying opportunity. But it hasn't come down nearly as quickly as it went up. And so far, it has held the breakout from that range between October and early December. So the VIX has to come down more in order to really demonstrate that we have a low of more than very short-term significance. What I think is also particularly important here is that there are a couple of countries that have been largely immune to what is going on. The Indian market, because there is the potential here that it is going to get this fiscal stimulus, has been reasonably positive, and the Nifty has held its sequence of higher reaction lows and is still above the trend mean. The banking sector as well has been leading the market higher and is pulling away from its trend mean. The Indonesian market has been really quite steady. So what this tells us is that it is not every market is pulling back, but there are some that are comparatively immune to what is really, I think, animating the minds of investors right now. Everyone is worried about the Trump administration and the volatility of the political process, but that is less of an issue than monetary policy, and it is monetary policy is the much more important factor that monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time, and monetary policy right now is tightening, and that tells us that we are in a position where things are likely to be more volatile, that we could be in a period of ranging for a pretty significant period of time. So this is, I think, a time to be a bit more cautious, because we are going to get some additional opportunities, and that those could potentially be at lower levels. Obviously, where there is very clear value starting to appear after very accelerated declines, that's probably where some of the easiest bargain hunting opportunities are. Now, I don't think we can talk about the rise of populism and volatility on the geopolitical scene without thinking about China. The Chinese market is trending down. Now, that more than anything else tells us that China needs a stimulus, that they need to deliver on what is required to really get the economy humming again. And so far that we've seen a lot of talk, but not a lot of action. It's also very true that bull markets in China tend to be state-sponsored. So we need state sponsorship in order to really start to see this market improving again. And so far, there's been very little evidence of that. Then, when we look at the market for the banking sector, it has broken its sequence of higher reaction lows. So that's another meaningful change. Now, the banking sector has done better over the course of the last few sessions, but it has broken its uptrend since July. So what this tells us is that markets don't go down for no reason. The underperformance of both China and Europe tells us that that's where the epicenters of risk are. That's where the real tightness in credit is. That's where the funding mechanisms are breaking down. That's where we've got the higher high yield spreads. And that also tells us that while everyone is worried right now about the USA, that the issues that are facing both China and Europe have not gone away, but that global liquidity tightness is likely to make them tighter. So that when we think about the opportunities in the emerging markets, I think the challenge for a lot of investors is going to be how to avoid having a position in China while also having a position in the emerging markets. And I think that the big challenge in the next few months is going to be to avoid those that have got the biggest potential to decline while bargain hunting for those that are less influenced by this tightening credit scenario. And the fact that gold prices are breaking out, I think, is telling us both that there is appetite for a safe haven, but then also that this that gold in particular has been a relatively depressed asset, and with very little people involved in it, and by that fact alone it represents a safe haven. And I think with that I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best and a happy new year to all of you.